Hi, everybody. I'm David Pelkovitz. I'd like to get some kind of discussion going after making some... Let me just see if I can do this. Is that okay, or is that the... You can hear me okay. Good. Okay. My topic is adolescence, right? It's surviving your adolescence. So I wanted to do is start... I wanted to talk a little bit about... there's actually a revolution in the last decade in terms of the way we understand adolescence, okay? And what I mean by that is that with the... It's something you wouldn't normally think about, but with the advent of new... neurologic research tools that are also medical diagnostic tools, like PET scans and MRIs and all kinds of fancy ways you could look into the brain. We now understand that that's sort of like a good audiovisual for adolescents. This is the, you know, sort of like the upheavals of adolescence. I like that. I'll try to arrange... By the end of the talk, we'll have it back up again, so it's a positive message. What they're finding now is that they were all wrong in the past about how psychologists understood adolescence. They used to think that pretty much brain development was pretty much finished by the time you were bar mitzvah. And what's now understood is that the adolescent brain is under construction. Okay, and what I mean by that is that the is the mic okay? Is that the adolescent brain is actually very, very different at the beginning of adolescence and by the end of adolescence. So, for example, the parts of the brain having to do with control of emotions is still very much undeveloped, but not only that, it's even working less well than it was earlier, because there's a certain amount of pruning and consolidation that takes place, and I won't go into boring details, but the bottom line is that there are reasons why adolescents are often so dramatic and have such poor judgment, okay? There's part of the biology that's now understood is that adolescents are much more likely than any other time of life to get into risk-taking. They're much more likely to get into novelty-seeking, wanting to look for something new. It's part of the way adolescents are wired, okay? Now, what happens in the course of adolescence is that there's a maturation that takes place, so that by 11th and 12th grade, there's increased myelinization of the neurons. So actually, the coating around the neurons of the brain gets more mature. And in all of the areas of the brain that are under construction during adolescence, the end is a much easier person to deal with than when they were younger. And we may have experienced this by looking at how much easier our later adolescent is to deal with than our earlier adolescents, although by no means are they perfect. But the areas that are impacted by brain development, in addition to being able to control their emotions, are areas like ability to take the perspective of others, ability to just sort of like look at consequences of actions, and in general, ability to see things in the more steady way that most adults have. And with that in mind, it's a helpful thing to understand, because if when we look at an adolescent being impossible, we could just say to ourselves, okay, this is what they do for a living. This is more what they're like at this age. Not that we excuse them. They still need limits. They need limits even more than they will at any other age. But just to understand it and not right away blame yourself and not right away blame factors that aren't really what's behind it, this is an important factor. It's not everything. It's not the whole picture. Of course, parenting goes into it and school stuff goes into it. And there's an enormous amount of information that that's feeding the system, making for problems that aren't necessarily related to these brain changes. But certainly, it now makes sense. A lot of what used to be puzzling about adolescence makes sense. Now, this is true in other, not just in humans. So, for example, research on rats even, right? The Torah tells us we could learn from animals as well, right? Research on rats shows us that rats will explore other parts of their maze they never explored before when they hit adolescence, more than they explored when they were pre-adolescent rats and more than they explore when they're adult rats. They also are more likely to take foolish risks in adolescence. Don't ask me how they measure that in rats. I don't think we want to know. And in general, across all groups, animals of all kinds, okay, are more likely to get into that kind of behavior. Now, with that said, that's not what I'm going to be talking about. I want to talk about practical approaches to adolescence. But I think that as an introduction, that's been the big change in the last decade in terms of the way we see them, and it helps us understand a little bit of what's going on with them. Two more points. Let me get away from the neurobiology of adolescence, and let's talk a little bit about what's going on psychologically with them, because that's important to understand also. Number one, what happens with adolescence in terms of what's new about them? A, is they hit the stage of what psychologists call formal operations, meaning they could think about thought. They could think on an abstract level in a way that's much more impressive than they were able to before. There's a reason why Chazal tell us Ben Chamesh Esrei LeTalmud, right? Ben Chamesh Esrei LeGemara. That we're not really at such a high, that most people are not at a high enough level of abstract thinking till they're into adolescence a little bit. But what happens is, remember from your own children when they were much younger, or from your grandchildren, let's say, where you see a little infant, when they learn something new, let's say they learn how to crawl, or they learn even when they're younger, they discover their feet or their hands, or they learn some new task, they become drunk with the power of that new task. Their whole being, their whole essence is focused on that. And that's what happens here as well. When adolescents learn to think about thought, and they learn to think abstractly, they begin to think that they know more than anybody else. They could question their parents, they could question their rebbeim, they could question any authority figure in their life, partly being fed by this newfound ability to think about thought. Okay, so that's number two, point number two. Point number three is you also have to remember that what adolescents are all about is the most important thing at that age is they believe that everybody's watching them. It's called the universal audience. They believe that they're the center of the universe. That's part of what's happening then as well. And as part of that, their biggest fear is not feeling like they belong to their peer group, like they belong to their friends. So it's normal for them to become independent, to want to have much less to do with you, to throw themselves into friends and wanting to be with friends in any way possible. And that drive to independence is a normal part of what adolescents are about as well. So you have those three interacting forces going on in terms of a hakdama, an introduction to understanding adolescence. A, their brain is under construction, which is going to make them have poorer judgment, less good control, and more of an interest in maybe taking risks and not being roes hanola, not being able to see the consequences of their actions. B, their thinking is different, so they think they know it all, they think they know better, and they're drunk with that abstract thinking. And C, they're at an age where what's most important to them is to be independent and to not have anything to do or to pull back protectively from adult authority and to throw themselves into friends and to be part of the crowd. Most of them don't want to stick out. Now, I know there are exceptions to all this, but that's the basic thoughts by way of introduction. Okay, so let me move on now to talking about why you're here, which is to talk about practical, what are the practical implications of this and what are some general approaches, and then I'd love to get some discussion going, okay? Number one, let's talk about the stuff that is normal, meaning it may be annoying, but areas that you don't have to have a red flag go up. So these are minor, troubling behaviors, but they're truly nothing to lose sleep over because they're part of what adolescents are all about. Okay? So I just want to go over that and then go to the more difficult tasks in terms of adolescent rebellion or questions you might have about at-risk behavior. What are minor but totally normal kinds of things? One, distance from you and focus on peers I talked about. Nothing to be concerned about. You just have to give them a little bit of space, and they'll come back to you as long as you can preserve the relationship in private. So they may not want to walk down the street with you as much and may resist taking family vacations with you, but they settle in, you know, and you need to figure out ways of keeping yourselves in their lives in spite of their developmentally driven need to pull back. And most of them will tolerate us, you know. I used to be an expert on adolescence till I had four of my own. I'm no longer an expert on adolescence, and I appreciate the difficulties of what the realities are. We once had the head of the child psychology at Harvard came to the hospital where I was working, and he told us that he didn't have any children till he was fairly old. He married relatively late in life, and he had his first child in his early 40s. And he said his wife had to physically hold him back from calling all of his former patients to apologize. Okay? And there's a lot of truth there, right? There's nothing so easy here. Ultimately, there's not such thing as a real expert in adolescence. And please don't get judgmental about your neighbor's kids, because I once had a Hasidic woman in my office who came to me with her 13th child. And she said the oldest 12 she had absolutely no problems with. And she was always very judgmental, she told me, about, you know, the way all of her friends were messing up their kids, and they do this wrong and do that wrong. And then she had her 13th child. And her 13th child, she said, had every single problem that she was always criticizing her friends for engendering in their children. And it, you know, gave her a healthy dose of humility about how much siyata dishmaya and how much, how complex this all is. Kids challenge us. Now, that's point number two in terms of the minor but annoying. It's important to remember the unique ways that adolescents challenge us. Adolescence is known as middlescence meets adolescence. That's the emotional struggle. So we're middle age. The average parent of an adolescent is at some point of their middle years. And they're at the beginning of their lives, and it's designed, their issues are designed to cut through us like a knife, okay? They're on the ascendancy. They have their whole life ahead of them. So they could afford to mess up maybe a little bit. They could afford to make certain choices that'll make them take a longer time to reach their career goals, let's say. They may not take things seriously. We know that they're making mistakes that maybe we made and wish we hadn't. And we want to save them from making mistakes that we made. And we can't. It's one of the most difficult parts of child rearing is that component, is the component of seeing things in our children that remind us of parts of ourselves that we're having difficulty with. But you grow through that. You know, parenting is a people-growing machine, to paraphrase a well-known psychologist who calls marriage a people-growing machine. But parenting is a people-growing machine. We grow through being able to connect to our adolescents in areas that they bring up in us that are probably our own unresolved areas. So when they say middlescence meets adolescence, they say the dreamer meets the disillusioned. So we might be looking at life through different colored glasses than the optimism and exuberance of young kids. And we have to remember that we have to make room for their spirit and their uniqueness and their temperament, okay? That's such an important part. You know, Breuer says a beautiful thing on the end of the pasuk, Chanoch l'nar al pi darko. We all know that pasuk, that we have to appreciate children's uniqueness. Chanochanar al pidarko, we have to find the unique path of children. But the end of the pasuk is, gam ki yaskin lo yasser mimenu. So he said, what does that mean? Because when you get older, lo yasser mimenu, children don't change their temperament. Pretty much, there's a consistency. And one of the things that any experienced parent learns is how little control we have over what our children are interested in, what they're fascinated by, what they're passionate about. The wisdom of parenting is often recognizing that we could shape them and we have to put limits on them and we could certainly put them in a certain direction, but ultimately, it's all within the framework of their temperament. The Vilna Gaon on that pasuk of Chanochanar al Pidarko says a brilliant point that is really what was being echoed by Rabbi Breuer. He says, Zeshakosav Chanochanar al Pidarko, Derech Tivo V'mazolo Kein Techei Lasos Mitzvos, right? You have to go according to their Teva. Because let's say you take a hyperactive kid who can't learn 10 hours a day. He says, the Vilna Gaon says, Ata yishma lecha me'es yuroso oscha. Now he'll listen to you out of fear. Avol be'es yusar olcha me'al tzavaro. When you take your foot off their neck, yosser mise. Okay? Why? Why will they leave it? Ki efshar l'shaver mazalo. Again, he's talking about the end of the pasuk. Gam ki yaskin lo yosser mimena. We can't shatter a child's mazel, a child's temperament. And he goes on to talk about the famous Gemara that talks about you could be born with a red temperament. Nowadays, it's called a frontal temperament. So you might have a temperament that makes you more likely to lose your temper, more likely to be impulsive, more likely to take risk. And Chazal tell us that you could go on three pathways with that, right? You could end up a murderer, you could end up a butcher, or you could end up a surgeon. Okay? But you're not going to end up in a field that doesn't in some way take into account that you have that frontal temperament. And that's so true. It's so true. I've seen phenomenally successful adolescents who, it's a no-brainer. The parents just sort of let them raise themselves. You just look at them a little crooked and they'll do the world for you. And then other kids that every single day the parents daven over them and cry over them and just worry horribly over them, okay? But as long as they maintain their love for them, ultimately I've seen them transform those difficult temperaments into incredibly successful adults. I see it over time and time again, okay? So, point number two in terms of these issues is please work with their temperaments, recognize their uniqueness, recognize your difficulty possibly with it based on your own issues. So for example, let's say you were similar. I see this all the time. Let me tell you a quick story. I've told this story before, but it's such a perfect story for this kind of topic. It's the story of a child, a teenager, comes into my office and the child has totally shut down academically, isn't working a drop in school. And I always want to meet with the parents first, so I sit down with the parents, I say, well, what's the deal here? And I said, let me hear a little bit about your childhood, because I know, middlescence meets adolescence, let me understand what ghosts of the past are coming up here. Sometimes I could get better insight that way. So the father tells me his background. I ask him about his attitude towards school. He says, I'm so glad you spoke to me about that because I have the following background. He said, my parents were Holocaust survivors. They were in the camps, and they were teenagers in the camp, and Hitler never allowed them to go to school. You know, they lost their high school education. And they met in a DP camp. They ended up in America. They started a business that was phenomenally successful. I was their only child, and as I was growing up, they told me, don't worry about school, it's not at all important. It's really not important at all. It's important to be happy, and we have the business for you. So don't worry, we'll put you in the business, everything will be fine. He said, I grow up, I get married, and I move to a community, move to a modern Orthodox community, where he's the only guy in the whole shul, and in the whole community, who doesn't have a college degree. If anything, he told me he thought everybody had a graduate degree. There's nobody else in his show that isn't a college graduate. And he felt very dumb. He felt very less than anybody else, even though he's a wonderful guy. And he told me he swore to himself that when he had children, he wasn't going to make the mistake his parents made. They're going to go all the way. They're going to go to the finest colleges and the finest graduate schools. And if they want to go into family business, fine. He was at that point running the family business. But he said he was going to see to it that they were going to get the finest secular education known to man. Now, you talk about bumper stickers. Every family has a bumper sticker. For him, what he wanted the bumper sticker of his family to be is Ivy League or bust. Harvard or nothing, okay? He said that was the gift he was going to give his children. Who did he marry? I turned to his wife and to the mother, and she says, well, she grew up in a family where her mother was incredibly emotional about academic achievement. And she told me, she says, you're not going to believe this, but it's a true story. She said that once her older brother came home with a report card that had a couple of 80s on it, and her mother let out a blood-curdling scream and fainted. Okay? And she told me that her mother's reactions to her report cards were no less emotional. And she took a shvua to herself that when she had children, she doesn't care if they're third grade dropouts. She's not going to put the slightest bit of academic pressure. Her bumper sticker was, have fun, relax, enjoy your childhood. That was the most important thing to her. Is it any wonder that children with such different dreams in terms of middle essence meets adolescence, okay, in terms of playing out our issues of the past, is it any wonder that this kid was confused? She couldn't win. She couldn't win, this high school girl. You know, if she performed well academically, she was getting all kinds of subtle messages from her mother. Hey, enjoy yourself. Well, you know, what are you such a grind for? And if she didn't do the absolute best she could do, I'm sorry, so, and if she didn't, then her father would be disappointed. Okay. So that's the challenge of parenting. The challenge of parenting is not just parenting an adolescent, it's not just recognizing the uniqueness of your child, but also recognizing how important it is to be aware of how you have to let your dreams go. They have to be allowed to make their own mistakes. You have to put limits on them. That's the key to parenting, is putting limits on them. But you have to do it in a way that recognizes the need to have them live their life based on their natiyas and their needs and their uniqueness. Okay, so that's that part. What else is within normal limits? Okay, what else is within normal limits are things like wanting to be on the phone all the time. Those of you who are in homes where there are computers loud and IM messages are going back and forth, where they're talking to each other nonstop on the computer. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the healthiest thing in the world. I just saw a family early this morning where the parents have taken the computer away, have taken the internet away from their child, because they noticed that as he was connecting to kids on the computer through instant messaging, his behavior was terrible. Then when they take him away from the computer to go on vacation, his behavior improved. So they took the computer away, but what they didn't realize was that he was getting access to the computer at other kids in the neighborhood. But they could always tell when he was on the computer because he was being dragged into the gutter by the interaction with other kids. That was the sign of a problem. But if you're in a situation where your kid is constantly wanting to connect to other kids and it's not making them terribly chutzpahdik because of it, or the influences aren't negative, then again, that's just what adolescents do for a living. That's what they're about. So that's that part. Self-consciousness is normal, right? I talked about the universal audience. They think they're at the center of the universe. They think the whole world's, everybody's eyes are on them. That's normal adolescence. Moodiness is normal adolescence, as long as the moodiness doesn't totally dominate their relationship with you and cut off from an ability to occasionally communicate with them, okay? Messy rooms, to get into specific behaviors. Again, that's what they're about. Choose your battlegrounds. It may make more sense to just close the door unless you own the problem. That's always the question you should ask yourself in terms of choosing battlegrounds. Who owns the problem? If you live in a house where they're living in a room that's their own room or they're sharing it with a sibling and you could close the door and company doesn't come near there, then let the kid own the problem. And if you want to, you could have consequences that we'll talk about how to deliver consequences in a few minutes. But if the answer is that you own the problem, let's say you have guests coming for Shabbos and they're going to see what a mess it is, or let's say roaches are now in the room or rodents are in the room because of what a mess it is, then you own the problem. Okay, that's an important issue. And then you have to come up with some of the recommendations that I'm going to be making to you. Okay? Eating habits almost always are not worthy battlegrounds. Forgetfulness about chores and intermittent negative attitude. All those are normal limit stuff. It doesn't mean that you don't put limits on them, but it means don't worry. Don't lose any sleep over this. This is adolescence. Okay? Now, let's talk about general approaches in terms of dealing with these minor but annoying issues. Approach number one, okay? You know, what's key guideline number one? Key guideline number one is adolescents hate nagging, they hate lecturing, they hate emotionalism, they develop parent deafness, right? They totally shut off to us if you keep telling them the same thing over and over again, and they're just not going to listen more times than not. A far more effective way of dealing with them is through a planned discussion. So planned discussion would be that if there's a recurring problem happening over and over again, let's say you notice, I don't know, that the phone bill is way up, or that they haven't been doing chores, or that their negative attitude is really crossing the line into more of a chronic chutzpah, then at that point, it's far better than dealing with it at the moment where they're just going to shut you down if you're yelling, screaming, and criticizing. You make an appointment with them. You say, look, you know, there's a time I'd like to sit down and talk to you calmly about this. When's a good time for you? And you make an appointment. It could be a day later. It could be 2 days later. It'll keep. But then when you get that appointment, it's very important to have no intrusions. You have your cell phone off. You have the phones in the house off the hook. You make sure the siblings aren't in the way. And you sit down with the child, and the first thing you do is try to hear it from their point of view. Try not to be angry, and you won't be because it's a planned discussion. And let's say the problem is they're not doing their chores. That their chores, let's say, the only thing you're asking the poor kid to do is to take out the garbage the night before garbage pickup and to dry the dishes, I don't know, or to do the dishes on two nights a week. And they're not doing it. They're somehow forgetting it, or they say, I'll do it later, or they just look at you in a puzzled way, you know, and that foggy look on their head. And you sit down with them, try to find out from them, call me, try to see it through their eyes. That makes an enormous difference. What is a wise man once said, to be understood, first understand. Very wise statement. Try to understand it through their eyes. You know, and usually they'll say at that point, chatasi, usually they'll say, you know, you have a point. If it's calm, they'll never say that if it's in the middle of you're being emotional with them or in the middle of lecturing or in the middle of nagging, okay? But if you could just hear their point of view, then just in a calm way say, look, you know, here's what I need from you, okay? And you come up with consequences for long term when they don't do it. Now, what consequences? What does the research tell us are the kind of limits that work best for adolescents? The kind of limits that work best are limits that are calmly delivered, like I just said, okay, and that are logical. They have to be mida keneged mida. They have to stem from the misbehavior, okay? So, for example, just off the top of my head, if they haven't done chores, it would be logical even to the adolescent if you then don't do something for them. So maybe you might not do the laundry for them that week, and maybe you don't give them a lift to go to someplace they really want to go to that week. So you do the chore for them, but you charge them for it metaphorically by then not doing something for them. It's logical. It's calm. They don't feel that it's arbitrary. What hurts adolescents the most, again, because of their newly formed ability to think about thought, is what really hurts them is when they feel somehow that what's happening is arbitrary authority that doesn't make sense, and they feel you're being unreasonable about it. But if they feel that it's coming from love, your limit setting, they may not act happy about it, but ultimately they're gonna hear it. Ultimately they're gonna be able to accept it. So calmly delivered and logical makes sense. The other part of it is show that you're really not angry at them, you're upset at their behavior. And the final part is don't over-punish. Don't ground them for the rest of their lives. It's truly tafas demur belo tafas. It's truly a situation where if you go for broke, you get nowhere. Okay? So those are the basic guidelines in terms of limits. I could tell you that at least four or five times in my practice, I've had the following situation. I've been in practice now for over 25 years. I think it's hitting more like 30 years, okay? I don't like to think about it, but I think it's hitting that. And a number of times I've seen people into the next generation. So independently, I've had people who are now parents. By the way, when you tell your child, be careful, I hope one day you'll have a child just like you. You ever hear that from a parent? It's a common thing. Be careful, because it often happens. It often happens. Okay, which may not be such a bad thing either. But a very interesting experience that I've had a number of times is adolescents who were going crazy in my office when their parents set limits. They'd go nuts. They'd scream. They'd yell. They'd lose it. I'm the only child in the whole world who has to be in early on a school night. I have a friend who's allowed as late as he wants every night as long as he does his homework on a school night. I've yet to meet that friend, by the way. Or I'm allowed to do this, or everybody else is allowed to do this. Horrible, most awful parents in the world. Then they'll come to me with their own kids, next generation. So I'm on the next generation now. And they'll say to me, by the way, Doc, remember years ago I was going nuts in your office about my parents' limits? Deep down, I was so happy they were doing it. Deep down, or not even so deep down, I was happy they didn't buckle. And I always knew that they were doing it from a place because they cared about me. Okay? Very, very true. Now, you're not going to get that nachas. They're not going to tell you that when they're adolescents. It's a perspective that you get later on, or that you're maybe able to share later on. A story that I've told about this, which I think is worth repeating, is I had a boy in my office who was really an at-risk kid. He was getting more and more out of control. His parents were wonderful, loving people, but they weren't so great in putting limits on him. So I developed a relationship with this boy. He was about 15. And I was getting nervous about him because he was getting into serious kinds of experimenting with all kinds of risky behavior, with drugs and all kinds of things. And I told the parents, you really have to get serious about limit setting with your son. And I wasn't doing it behind the boy's back. And we had a session, me, the parents, and the boy. And they said, look, from now on, you're not allowed out on weeknights. From now on, you're not getting any money from us unless we know exactly where it's going. Well, they just had a whole list of limits. They should have been put on him a long time earlier. He's going crazy. He's screaming. He's yelling as they're saying this. And I saw they were about to back down, but also I was worried that he was going to get physically violent. He'd never had this experience before. So I asked his parents to wait outside in the waiting room. They go into the waiting room. When I was sure that, when he was sure that they were out of earshot, he looked at me and he said, you know something, Doc? It's about time. It's about time. Very, 100% true story. And the nicest thing about the story is I've kept up with him. He's already way past that stage. He's actually a very respected rabbi now, okay, with his own kids who were wonderful kids, you know. They had, and this kid totally turned around. He just needed to have that mid-course correction. I'm not saying it was easy. It didn't get better right away. There were a couple of tough, bumpy years after that. But once the parents started firmly and calmly setting limits, everything turned around, okay? So in terms of the limit setting, again, let's review it. Calm, okay? Planned discussion, logical, mida keneged mida, and if it makes sense to the kid, or even if the consequences in collaboration with the kid, it'll work better. And not overly long, not overly harsh, okay? Those are all things. There's also one more piece. There's a beautiful story about Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach, not the famous musician, his grandfather. His grandfather, I believe, had 6 children. And he had a strict rule that his kids in Europe would have to go to Minyan every morning and be there on time. And his policy was, okay, he wouldn't say anything to you if you weren't in Minyan. But that morning, for breakfast, all the kids would have bread with jelly, okay? And whichever kid didn't show up to Minyan would just know they weren't allowed to have the jelly. But then there was something very interesting that he did. Any morning that one of his children didn't have jelly, Rabbi Carlbach did not have jelly. What a message. It was a terrific message. It was a message saying, look, this has nothing to do with you. This has to do, I love you. I'm in pain also with you. This has to do with your behavior. An incredible message, okay? So in terms of setting limits, set them with love as well. Okay, that's what the Gemara tells us. The balance between smoldocha v'min makareves, the balance between love and limits is what parenting and adolescence is all about. And they know it. They know it. They say rules without relationships equals rebellion. They know whether or not your rules are arbitrary, coming from anger, or coming from a true love for them. It's a fascinating medrash. There's a pasuk in Mishlei, Yaser bincha ki yesh tikva ve'el hamiso al titei nafshecha. It says, put limits on your kid. There's always hope. And don't listen to their cries. So I found an amazing medrash on this pasuk. It says, kol hamosif ha'av yisurim al bino, mosif ha'av ahaben ahava al aviv. What an incredible concept. It says, you know something? It says, the more you put limits on your child, the more your child will love you. Incredibly psychologically sophisticated concept. And it's so true. They don't show it to you. That's the hard part. They're not going to give you the satisfaction of saying, oh, thanks, I needed that. They're not going to do that. But they know it. That's what they're after. So this generation are experts in love with kids. Not such experts necessarily in putting limits, okay? So let's pull it together, and I'd like to get at least some discussion going. Number one, I started by talking about what we understand now about adolescence, that there's a sea change in our understanding of adolescence. We now understand that some of what's going on may be a little more can't than won't. Not that they really can't, but that what they're about, what they do for a living is that they're moody, they don't have such great judgment, they're after new things, and they'll be risk takers, they don't always see the big picture. That's what their wiring is about. It doesn't mean they won't respond, it doesn't mean they really can't, it means it's harder for them at that age. That's number one. Looking at them and saying, okay, this is getting that distance, so this is coming in part from what adolescence is all about. It's about that, it's about they're being drunk with thinking they know the answer to everything because they've hit abstract thinking ability for the first time, and it being totally normal for them to want to be with friends all the time, and this, you know, that social thing, and to put you aside for now, it's temporary. Eventually, God willing, you'll get them back. That's number one. Number two, in terms of the limit setting, you do it with the calmness, you do it with the logic, you do it in a way that preserves the connection. That makes an enormous difference. And number three, be aware of some of the issues that might get in the way in terms of either your setting limits or in terms of an inability to set limits or an inability to really connect to them, because they will raise in you exactly the issues that probably need to be raised in you. Unresolved issues going back to your own childhood, and that's fine. You grow through that. I quoted the Vilna Gaon before. He says in another pasuk often used in terms of understanding parenting, he says, it says in Mishlei, "Hachsek b'musar al teref nitzra kihi chayecha." Hold on to self-improvement. Hold on to self-improvement. Don't weaken. It's your life. And he says that that kimasha ha'adam chai. The purpose of life is lishbar mashalo shavar at heina osa hamida. He says, we have to take the areas that are hardest for us and work on it. Because he says, otherwise, lama lo chayim. Otherwise, what's the purpose of life? And what others have said he means by that is that when we are engaged in struggling with things that are harder for us, so if we have a temper and we're engaged in trying to control our temper, where we have issues that we feel we haven't reached our potential, but our kids, they can. We may not have made it to Lakewood, or we may not have been able to learn, you know, the way we would have liked to, or we may not have been able to be as good a person as we wanted to. But our children, they will. We're going to save them from making the mistakes we did. So when you struggle to pull back and let your child find their own uniqueness, okay, which is the key to parenting an adolescent, he says at that point, you're fulfilling your purpose in life. That's when you're living life to the fullest. So when you're struggling and they're cutting through you like a knife, that's a good sign. It means you're doing the work of life. That's what life is about. Nothing like having children to do that for you. You know, there's a saying, a mother could only be as happy as her unhappiest child, okay? And it's very hard not to really worry when one of our adolescents is struggling. But ultimately, as long as they know that you're in it with them, and as long as you're available to them to the extent that they'll allow you, there's an excellent chance that things will come back and eventually one day they'll be able to understand why you were doing the things that you were doing with them. Let me get some discussion going, and we have about 10 minutes. Ask away, people. I'll assume you're asking about your neighbor's child, so you don't have to worry about... I know it's hard in a room like this, in an auditorium, but let me, yes, please. Yeah. Yeah, the question is, what if you see a decline in a child who it's more won't than can't? A kid who used to be doing fine and now their grades are dropping. That's a good question. I thank you for that because I meant to talk about it a little bit. The general guidelines go like this, that in terms of academic performance, if the child is doing well, so let's say, I don't know, you agree that an average of 90 or over, 85 or over in general studies and good reports from Hebrew studies, let's say they're doing fine, okay? Then it's almost always better to pull back. They've earned the right to let, you know, they know how you feel about it, and it's much better to just be there if they need you to be there. Ask them how you could help them and help them. But otherwise, if they're doing fine, you're much better off letting them to continue that internalized sense of love of learning and doing okay. But let's say you have a kid who's always been a good student. Now they're much more interested in hanging out with friends. They're much more interested in being on the phone, or they're certainly not interested in studying, which happens a lot, and they begin to come home with grades below 80, let's say. So at that point, it's, again, that's time for planned discussion. You sit down with them. There, the logical consequence is obvious, is you let them know that until they get a certain number of tests brought home, meeting a certain standard, let's say if they can, above 90, you're going to really stay on top of them. And it means that you're going to have limits on them, not punishments. It's logical consequences. It means they may have to go to bed a little bit earlier. It means you may not let them out on weekends. It may mean that they have to, on school nights, have very little downtime. But let them know they could earn it back the second they come home with X number of grades over 90s, or the second you call a Rebbe up and tells them, oh, he's really learning now. You know, that usually, that kind of logical, calm talk, then what you're doing is you're putting it back in their court. You're saying it's your choice. You choose what to do here. So if you choose to really try, then we know you could do it. You've always done it. So bring that in, and then you go right back to the way it was before. But they have to earn that right. Yes. Yeah, and has never been able to make decisions. So to repeat the question, what happens if you have an indecisive child who just can't, it just sort of like is always waffling and has a hard time making decisions? Is this a child who's also a little bit perfectionistic as well? Or, not perfectionist, it's just indecisive. Just indecisive. Yeah, there are people who just by personality are indecisive types. That's a tough question. I don't have any easy answers. The ultimate thing you need to learn, as with adults, is that there's never only one right decision. You know, to help them see any decision you make will be right, as long as it comes from talking it out, etc. But ultimately, the kindest thing you could do for them is to give them a deadline of some kind. So let's say they're trying to figure out what yeshiva to learn in Eretz Yisrael. Give them the illusion of choice, let's say. Okay, here's the three that we decided you have to choose. Then you give them a firm deadline. You say, by such and such a time, you are going to have to tell me one way or another, and let them know whatever they decide, it's going to be fine. It's what's meant to be, and then let them know you're sending the deposit in on that day. You don't let them agonize, you know, that kind of thing. Then you let them know. So you say, look, if the deadline is on such and such a date, then you'll make, if they don't, that's fine. You'll decide it for them. That's fine. Yeah. Right, and that's another, these are all excellent questions. In other words, the question is, okay, you know, it's one thing for me to talk in this theoretical way about logical consequences and about an approach, but what happens if the decisions they're making, you know, are going to impact on their future, you know, is going to get them into a less desirable yeshiva or less desirable college, and you know that one day they're going to even be angry at you that you didn't force them to do it. Very common question, very poignant question, because it's so difficult. What do you do about that? All I could say to them, and I know it's not a satisfying answer, is that all a parent could be held accountable for is setting limits in a calm way in the here and now. There's certain behaviors we have no control over, right? You can't lock them up and throw away the key. So let's say they're making decisions that you know are going to cost them. They're not going to be able to get into the best seminary. They're not going to be able to get into the best college or whatever it is based on where on the spectrum you are. All you could do is you could put limits on them. So you could say, look, you know, here's the parameters of what we as parents feel is necessary. So you have to stay in, you have to do this. But ultimately, you could just be responsible for consequences that make sense in the short term. Constantly giving them hope. You could impact, I'm going to have to, what's this? Oh, thank you. Thanks. You're going to have to impact, let ultimately, kids may very well make mistakes that will cost them. That's just the reality. That's what adolescence is about. Yeah, so in terms of the partnership with school. Their partnership is great, because very often kids will hear it better from the school than they will from the parents, or they'll hear it from a Rebbe or a teacher who they have a good relationship with. So I think it makes a lot of sense. See, logical consequences from the school makes the parents' job a lot easier. Then you just have to get out of the way, and if the school is giving detention, or the school's giving extra work, or the school's giving something that will hopefully motivate the child, or if the school's retaining the kid or making the kid go to summer school, that's the best gift you could get from a school sometimes in terms of letting them know. Ultimately, though, what parents need to know is you have to have perspective. Many, many kids who are disasters in their adolescent years are totally different once they're playing for keeps in the next stage of their lives. We know so many, especially boys, we know so many examples like that where kids turn themselves around. That's why the main thing you could do is just stay in there, and as long as you preserve your relationship with them, you're going to be in a much better place. Yes.
Thank you.
No, well, yeah, that's the easiest question of the day, okay? No. obviously, there's no reason why. There, the worst thing you could do is to in any way give him an allowance, right? That's just saving him from facing the consequences of his own action. And, he absolutely should have no, in other words, there, almost always, when you stop saving them, and they have to hit the harsh reality, they're not going to be able to put gas in the car, they're not going to be able to do anything fun, they're not going to be able to meet basic needs, you sound like you're putting them out of the house, then absolutely you shouldn't give them a dime. He's too old for that. That's an entitlement that he certainly is too old for. Let him earn his own money. Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. What's that? Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wait. Are two people answering at once? Okay. Who's the other person? Raise your hand. The person in the back? Who was it? Who is talking also? Cause you go right after this and we'll make that the last question because I know it's time for the next session. I also have to apologize. I unfortunately have to run out right after this. It's an unusual thing for me, but I very much wanted to be here, so I came even though I have another commitment out on Long Island very soon after this. So my deal was that I was going to run out afterwards, so I apologize ahead of time. But let's take those last two comments. Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. The question has to do with, right, and I meant to clarify that from the biologic standpoint, very often early adolescents are the tougher years because they're not wired. But there are plenty of other issues than neurobiology going on. So sometimes there are issues that are more likely to come out in late adolescence, like that previous question about the 20-year-old who's just not doing it, who's sort of shut down. Some later adolescence, there's a transition into less structure, a transition into choices that many kids have a harder time with. So it's just a sign that different issues have triggered them. Some of us have particular difficulty during certain times in life. Transition to young adulthood is very hard for other kids. Transition, any transition period tends to be very tough. So it's not a sign of a more severe problem or harder problem to understand. It's just a problem of not better or worse, just different. So, yeah. And who is that? Let's make that somebody who was talking before, please talk, and I'll make that the last thing. Who? And is that dominating or just at times? It's dominating. And it's at school as well? Not at school, only at home? If it's dominating, I would probably go for a mental health consultation, not because it's a sign of a horrible problem, but because the fact that it's not showing itself at school is good news, because it means that it probably is reactive to something going on at home, either an annoying sibling or an annoying parent or whatever, or their annoyance, and sometimes short intervention might really make a difference. I always worry about that only when it's dominating. Who wants to have that dominate the adolescent years? And if there's a way around it, I would definitely suggest going for help. It could really make a difference. And it often does. Thank you, everybody. Sorry to have to run.